Well, welcome to Keys to the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the kingdom of God. And where to start is always a good question, because almost everything is about the kingdom of God. And so no matter what subject you bring up, you know, it's like one of those comedy deals where they give you a phrase and you're supposed to create a comedy routine. Well, you give me a phrase and I'm supposed to create, you know, a discussion, a lecture, a talk, a preaching about the kingdom of God. And so we started about three shows ago talking about devotional. And if you look up the word devotion, you see it means love, loyalty, or enthusiasm for a person, activity, or a cause. And so they have at churches devotionals. And they think that when they go to a devotional at a church, that they're actually doing something that Christ would want you to do, that Jesus would want you to do. And I assume that they do this in Jewish synagogues and mosques and all the different religious groups that gather together. They have their devotional towards showing their enthusiasm for a person, activity, or a cause. They even give a definition: religious worship or observance, prayer, or religious observance. These are the kind of definitions you find under the word devotion. But I'm going to tell you that 90% of what you see has nothing to do with love, loyalty, or even enthusiasm for Christ or God. It is not an activity that lends itself to the worship of God. It has nothing to do with being fruitful and multiplying or dressing and keeping it. It is a mental trip. It is a mental and emotional trip for your mind to make you feel good about the fact that you don't really have a lot of devotion, love and loyalty, and enthusiasm for Christ. So you have these events they call devotionals to make you feel good and imagine that you actually love Jesus. Now that's a mean thing for me to say, but you know, hey, it's me. That's the truth. Because when we were told to dress it and keep it and to love our neighbor as ourselves, these are actually jobs. And loyalty to Christ means that you're going to actually be doing that. To love in the way that Christ loved has to do with laying down your life daily, bit by bit, piece by piece, moment by moment, for Christ in service to those neighbors that you're supposed to love as yourself. Has nothing to do with an emotional created event at some church playing music and mumbling words. Prayer is not a bunch of words. Jesus very clearly didn't say, repeat after me. He says, pray in like manner, and describes an attitude of prayer. It's not about you saying words. We have a strong delusion. It comes out of a lot of different things that we'll touch on. But if you want to do a devotional to God, show a little loyalty. Start doing what he said. You want to have a devotional to Christ, start loving your neighbor as much as yourself. Fulfill your duty to God and your fellow man. That's religious devotional. That means gather together and take care of one another when there's real need, in a way that strengthens even the very poorest amongst you. That's devotional. That's a devotional. going to a building and, you know, setting the scene, getting the lights right, you know, assuming the position, you know, maybe you kneel down. That always makes you feel like you're humble. Doesn't make you humble. Makes you feel like you're humble. And that's, it's all about feeling. That's what religion has become, all about feeling and ideas. What you think about God and what you feel about God. So we started this devotional series, and then we progressed onto the moral arc. What is the moral arc? And actually, there's a number of people that talk about the moral arc in history and in society. And there was a fellow, if I can remember his name, Theodore. I cannot recall his name right offhand. But anyway, he talked about the moral arc, and there are books written about this concept of the moral arc. But somebody who's coined the phrase fairly recently is Michael Shermer, and he's the big debater about. Refers to people and who have this religious belief, you know, as superstitious, and it's kind of he's the head of the Skeptic Society, etc. Best-selling author, very popular with some people, not so popular with others. He supposedly has this exploration of science and morality that demonstrates how the scientific way of thinking has made people and society as a whole more moral. Is that actually true? This is his kind of the basis of his presentations in his speaking. He makes a lot of money going around speaking to people who like to pay him to hear him tell them this stuff, which is actually the reverse. The truth is actually the reverse of what he's saying, but he's very, very clever at what he says. And so a lot of people think, you know, he's the high priest of atheism today, of actually the high priest of immoral behavior. That's right. You know, he talks about that there's supposedly all this talk about moral decline these days. But Michael Shermer, this author of, let's see, he wrote We People Believe Weird Things, or Why People Believe Weird Things, and Believing Brain, The Believing Brain. And we just put up a little series on our wiki site, which is preparingyou.com, on the brain, on the mind, and try to give you a little bit of insight into exactly what this 3-pound organ is and what it is doing, what it can do, and the delusions it can cause. And one of the delusions is found in people with religious beliefs. But that doesn't mean there isn't a God, that there isn't a heaven, that there isn't realms beyond this, because science is coming out. If you go listen to our series and read our series on quantum and the string theory and that, you'll see that science is actually saying that there is this parallel realms next to us where entities can actually exist and live, but it's a different realm with different parameters than our own physical realm. But yet there's supposedly creatures living right parallel to us, right next to us, but in another realm. You can't see them necessarily from this realm. Most people can't. But they're supposedly there. And science is coming up with this. Some of the top physicists and theorists in science today believes that this exists. And they've done scientific experiments that shows that this must be the case, that there must be these other realms. And they've actually pierced the veil between these realms, and they see energy going out and disappearing and then coming back into this realm. Now, if you want to see if there is this other realm, you just, you know, jump off a bridge and then you'll find out if there is such a realm. Problem is there's supposedly multiple realms. They think 9 or 10 different realms. There could be hundreds. They don't know. Because once you get into a realm, maybe there's another realm next to that. I don't know. And Jesus says, in my Father's house, there are many mansions. So what's his Father's house? And he talks about, you know, some people actually think that there are no demons and devils. And there's a reason why they come to that conclusion. There's actually a psychological reason why they come to that conclusion. And once you start seeing all the different pieces of the puzzle of the universe, the mysteries of the universe, you'll start to see why they think that way. Somebody I know who is very spiritual, when he hears people talking like that, he goes like, I don't get how they even think that. It's just so foreign to him. But there's actually a reason why they begin to think that. And there's articles written on the internet, and I actually know some of the people who've written them, that talk about how, no, that Jesus was just curing people of mental illness. They thought they were possessed, but there's no actual real demons. There's no real actual other spiritual people that we can blame things on. Now, that's an interesting thing, the way they put that we can blame things on. Just because there are real demons and devils and spirits in other realms adjacent to our own realm doesn't mean you get to blame what you're doing on them. If they have power over you, if you feel the burden of their curse, it may be not because, you know, they're responsible for what they're doing, but you feel the burden, there's a chink in your armor. Something is missing in you that leaves a home for them in you, or a place in you where they can influence your thinking. They will put thoughts in your mind. They can actually give you feelings and emotions and experiences by triggering certain places in your mind. They can give you pleasure or pain. They can give you anxiety in your mind by just reaching into this realm slightly. How is it that they're getting into your mind? Because there's a chink in your armor between that realm and this. You see, your mind can access that other realm. You've learned not to do it, or you've forgotten how to do it, because of the fact that it's too scary. When you're about 2 years old, sometimes children start to see that other realm, see things popping in from that other realm, and they are very frightened. And they learn to shut it off, to look away, not look at it. It's too scary. I don't want to look at it. And so they don't see that other realm anymore. You know, and they get through the terrible twos. But you see, if you actually see, there's multiple realms. There's a realm that we call heaven. You know, that's the label that we put on it. And there may be many levels to that heaven, because of course now the words we see in the Greek text about heaven, some of it just means up there in the sky. But then they talk about multiple heavens, other heavens, third heaven, you know, that kind of thing. So what's that? These other realms where somebody lives. Well, there's hell, that's a realm. And there's heaven. And that's supposedly a realm. Are they really all different realms? Or are they different rooms? Different parts of the universe? Different parts of creation? Where, you know, like if you go to Turkey, things look different in Turkey. If you go to England, things will look different in England. And those are realms. And when the devil was, or a spirit named Legion, because there were many supposedly in this person who was running around and doing crazy things and everything, and sees Jesus and runs towards Jesus, and Jesus has a conversation with this thing, you know, Legion in this person. And doesn't want to be cast out to another country. Well, that same word that we see translated country in the Bible, elsewhere it's translated region, to another region. And if this is a spiritual entity inside a man, possessing that man, speaking to Christ, naming himself separate from that man because there are many spirits with him, and he's saying, don't cast me to another region. Is he talking about, you know, to South Wales? Or is he talking about to these other realms? You know, and of course now I could be just conjecturing all this based on the words that I see there, because some people will want to imagine, no, he's just dealing with somebody who's mentally ill, who imagines that these, multiple personalities, and he's calling themselves Legion because he has all these multiple personalities. Well, why in the world is this personality saying doesn't want to be cast to another region? And Jesus agrees and casts them into these pigs, who immediately run down and destroy themselves and drown in the water. And of course, that's kind of what the man seemed to almost be doing, is destroying himself, causing himself pain and injury and all these kinds of things, cutting himself, because there's a spirit in him that wants to feel the pain. It is manifesting what we would call a psychological problem. It's trying to experience pain by damaging the very body that allows them to experience pain. You know, like cutters. Does that mean that cutters are possessed by demons? It may mean that they're influenced by demons or the spirit of demons, and they're developing the same ideas that are in certain demons, certain spirits. And they're falling prey to thinking the same way. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're possessed, but it may mean that they're influenced by. You can be influenced by the person who sits in the desk next to you. Their attitude. I once had a job where I had to go around to different buildings. I was a property manager. And somebody else took over my job, and I went around with that individual to show them the different buildings and introduce them to the different caretakers at each building. And I noticed that his whole personality would change when he walked into the room with different people, because we had different kinds of managers, different kinds of people there. Some were very religious, some were not. Some were a little bit, you know, rough around the edges in the rougher neighborhoods. And but they're all, you know, pretty honest, normal, nice people. They're just different, a little different. But when he would walk into one room with these people, never having met them before, he immediately changed his personality. You could see, if you're observant, an immediate change in his personality, in the way he spoke, the way he acted, the speed at which he spoke. His whole demeanor would change when he walked into the room with somebody else. He knew how to change. And he was just winning everybody over. Everybody thought he was great. I had known the guy. I didn't hire this guy. Somebody else hired him. I even advised against hiring him, because I had known this guy before he ever even came to that work. I seen him in another environment entirely, and knew that he was an absolute low-life, degenerate individual who could not be trusted. But the owner of the business didn't take my advice and hired him anyway. And, I didn't want to defame the guy too much. I actually knew his brother, too. His brother was a pretty decent sort of guy. But he could be anything to anybody. And he knew what to be almost instantly, just walking in the room. How did he do that? He didn't even know how he did that, but he was good at it. And, you know, my experience with preachers across the country and ministers and all kinds of different people, I see that some people have this ability to influence the people around them by changing their whole demeanor, like a chameleon. You know, they just come in the presence of somebody and they know what to say and how to say it, and they start influencing that person. Salesmen have that ability too. There's different kinds of salesmen. But they know how to manipulate people. Well, there is spiritual realms, and in those spiritual realms, certain entities will be drawn towards you for a reason, and they will attempt to influence you. And if they can influence you, you may call this a curse. You may even develop into what you might call possession, because they possess the way in which you act and react. And they could actually get so far as they actually inhabit you, like we see in this case in the Bible, where you're possessed. But they have no power except what we allow them to have, that we give over to them. Now, if you ask Michael Shermer this, he will think, you're absolutely crazy. There's no scientific evidence. Yet, when I talk about these multiple realms, that is the result, that opinion of these multiple realms. Now, I see it from another point of view, but in the scientific community, the top scientists in the world are now accepting the idea that there are multiple realms, based on scientific observation. But what how's that going to affect you on your day-to-day life? Well, just log it away. One of the things that we learn from the Bible is that there were two trees, a tree of life and a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we have those metaphors talked about in the Bible. Of course, people make one of them an apple tree, which I think is highly unfair. that you make the tree an apple tree. I like apples. But the tree, this is the tree, and they tell you that the tree is not an apple tree, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Your brain. If you look up the article, Dendritic Tree, on our website, you'll see what I'm talking about. This brain is your tree of knowledge. You were given a tree of knowledge, not as a source of wisdom, but as a tool. And it's an instrument, just like your body, your hand, is a tool. It can do good things, it can do bad things. You don't give power to your hand to do whatever it wants, but you give power to your brain to think whatever it wants. And you do this when you walk away from the tree of life. You have no governor ruling over the tree of knowledge if you walk away from the tree of life. And how do you walk away from the tree of life? You deny the truth. And usually you deny the truth about yourself. And now the tree of knowledge is all you have left. You can't go back to the tree of life without admitting the truth about yourself. So you're stuck in the tree of knowledge. And men like Michael Shermer build tree houses there. And they dwell in them. And me, I like to shake the tree. And that's what we're going to do when we come back to Keys to the Kingdom. We're going to shake Michael Shermer's tree and a lot of other people's tree at the same time. And we'll see what falls out. Okay, we'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So we're talking about reason, thinking, the brain, the mind. And trying to figure out the mind with the mind is kind of like trying to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Very egotistical approach to life. You have to think that I'm so smart, I can figure me out. I can raise me and my intelligence higher than my intelligence is right now. And, you know, I understand how seductive such a thought is, but I also know how vulnerable the mind is to influences. And I was telling somebody, explaining something to somebody the other day, and I think I've actually written something on this in one of the articles, but I think I did on the one on the mind, is that choice. We supposedly have free choice. We're given an inalienable right to choose. And now, to the evolutionist, there's nobody there to give them an inalienable God-given right to choose. They just don't exist to the evolutionist, the atheistic evolutionist. There is no God. There is no, you know, intelligent design, because there is no, it's just a matter of evolution. It's just chemistry, right? Well, then there is no inalienable right to choose. See, so now you've opened the door to democracy. The majority will choose. The individual has no inalienable right to choose, so the majority gets to choose. See, I mean, who made democracy God? It's mob rule. But that's what they have to do if evolution is true. You have to go to democracy. And those of you who've listened to the shows on democracy, according to all the forefathers and bright, intelligent people back in the 1700s, 1800s, that democracy, and you can even go back to Plutarch and Socrates, democracy leads to tyranny. So, wait a minute. So what's so good about democracy? Well, most early Americans opposed democracy. They were absolutely adamantly against democracy. And if you actually go back in history and look at what they're saying about democracy, you come up with a very interesting observation, scientific observation of opinions, is that Karl Marx was one of the few people who liked democracy, because it leads to communism and, you know, socialism, and then socialism leads to communism. So he was in favor of democracy. Most other people, you know, Jefferson and Washington, they were not in favor of democracy. And until 1927, if you read like the Army Field Manual, it told you that democracy was an evil, wicked form of government that led to tyranny and despotism. But then somebody said, we got to change that or we'll never get a democracy. So, of course, by 1945, the Army Field Manual said something else, told you about how great democracy was. And you all have accepted that idea. You've been influenced. Somebody trimmed some of the branches in your tree of knowledge and grafted in other branches and said, oh, democracy is good. Democracy is wonderful. And you've accepted it. Not very many years ago, everybody knew democracy would lead to tyranny. And that's why they didn't create a democracy in early America. Now, there was a republic, but that existed long before the Constitution. I mean, there were troops actually sent over from Great Britain back in the 1600s to defend the American Republic. That was what it said, quote, unquote, defend the American Republic in the orders for the troops. Whoa. What republic? Back then, in the 1600s? You see, you don't understand what a republic is. Why? Because somebody's been clipping and trimming your tree of knowledge. You didn't know that? You didn't know that the American Revolution was defending the republic that already existed? You think that somehow they threw off a legitimate government What does the Declaration of Independence say? Unwarranted usurpations. They didn't have a right to assert the authorities. They weren't revolting against the king. The king was revolting against the republic. He was assuming authority he did not have over at least a third of the American population because they were landed freemen. You don't even have any idea about that. Somebody's trimmed those branches out of your personal tree of knowledge. And you don't know that. You probably think the Constitution created a republic. You don't even know what you think a republic is an indirect democracy. That's not what a republic is. You know, one of the most common books you would find on the bookshelves, I mean, of course, it was like the Almanac and stuff. That would be the most common. But when we get into more scholastic things, is Plato's Republic on the bookshelves of farmers. And why do they always call it Plato's Republic? Because it was his version of a republic that wasn't really a republic. That's a republic, if you go back in history to the original phrase, libera res publica, it means free from things public. It means that your rights don't extend from the government. Your rights extended from somewhere else originally. From generation to generation, your rights were passed down to you by your fathers and your forefathers and God himself, whoever created mankind. That's where your rights came from. They didn't come from government. That's the way it is in a pure republic. But in indirect democracy, the democracy has all the rights, and they let you have some of them back. And that's what they created with the Constitution, that's what they created with the Constitution, was an indirect democracy. But you weren't a party to it. You didn't sign the Constitution. It wasn't even put to a vote because it didn't have anything to do with the average American living on his land in fee simple, untaxed by all the world, had become a tough nut for any imperial power to crack. Not so with you. You don't live on your land in fee simple. You are heavily taxed, and you are because you have signed lots of things. Not the Constitution, but lots of other documents. And one of the things that the Constitution guarantees you, the right to contract. Now, I can hear out there in radio land a lot of people saying, well, I never understood the terms of the contract and everything. And that's because the fact that you're an idiot doesn't give you an excuse. That just makes you mentally incapable of being free. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if it's okay for somebody to take away from your neighbor so that you can have free things, it's okay for your neighbor to take away from you so they can have free things. You've already set the pattern of the branches of your life. You've already signed over your devotional loyalty to a way that is contrary to Christ. It's a covetous way. It's a way where you want something and you want your neighbor to give it to you. And so you hire men to take away from your neighbor so that you can get what you want. And you tell me who hasn't done that. Did you go to public school? Then your parents did that. Public school is a socialist system where you force your neighbor to pay for your education. If your education costs $10,000 a year to pay for your school, which is very common, there's some school districts will charge over $20,000 per student because they have, you know, very high wages for and benefits for their teachers. But you send one kid, that's $10,000 a year in taxes. Are you paying that? Well, then your neighbor's paying it for you. That's a covetous relationship with your community. You got two kids in school, that's $20,000 a year. You paying that $20,000? No. So therefore, you're forcing your neighbor to pay it. You got three kids in school? I had six kids. If I had put them in school, that would have been $60,000 a year. I'm forcing my neighbor to shell out so that I can have free education. Now, I don't personally force them. I don't go down to their house and force them. I got other people to do that. Other minions. But it's still a covetous relationship. It's not loving your neighbor. It's loving your neighbor's stuff. You can't be a Christian and send your kids to public school. Now, you can want to be a Christian and want to figure out a way to educate your children outside of school. You know, people like Einstein didn't go to public school. He was educated at home. Isaac Newton, he was educated at home. You'd be surprised. There's a list. You know, look at, Google it. There's a huge list of people who educated. My son was reading it on his phone the other day and was saying, look at, and he was naming all these people, and I can't remember all the names, but there's a lot of people educated at home. Great achievers. And statistics, scientific statistics, show that homeschool education score 30% higher than kids who go to public school. Now, people can rationalize that away, but the fact is now many of your colleges are yearning, jumping at the chance of getting homeschoolers enrolled because they're less trouble and they're better achievers, better students. They go on. None of them end up on welfare, unemployment, and so therefore they're great alumni because they will become successful people, and successful alumni donate to the college. But don't get me started on your modern educational system. The point is, it's a covetous relationship, and it's come up. You know, people like Galileo, Newton, Thomas. Hobbes, Martin Luther King, thinkers throughout history have consciously employed scientific techniques to better understand the non-physical world. So they say, and people who write about Schumer. But you can't understand the non-physical world unless you have something more than the brain, because the brain can come to conclusions, and we'll show you how Schumer has come to conclusions not based on science. Moral observations he's made not based on science. He thinks the world, because of its scientific examination, is a more moral world. When covetousness is one of the Ten Commandments, saying covetousness is not moral. Desiring to take away from your neighbor for your personal benefit, or even for the benefit of others, but especially for your personal benefit, is immoral. You know, it's not stealing necessarily. We're not talking about stealing. That there's another commandment, thou shalt not steal. But there's a commandment that thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's, including thy wife. Now, you don't even understand today, the modern thinking, you don't even understand why you couldn't covet a man's wife. Now, you think that means, you know, like, having, what do they call it, wife swapping or something. No. It means that your family was a unit. No more twain, but one unit. And so therefore, whatever was in your family, your wife, your children, everything, that was yours to be passed down to the next generation, untouched from generation to generation. Remember, the kingdom of God is from generation to generation. Now, that principle is something you will find not only in this realm, but in the next. And in the next. This is a universal principle. The right of possession to be passed down entirely from generation to generation is a fundamental principle of the universe. We see it manifested in genetic code, where you link the genetic code of your wife and the genetic code of the husband. They link together and they are passed down to the next generation. If you interrupt and violate that genetic code, you get macabre distortions. So it's sacred that you do not interfere with that spiritual DNA and physical DNA passing down from generation to generation. Most people don't understand the difference between soul and spirit. Soul is including two things, the corporeal and incorporeal hereditaments of personality. Complicated statement. It means all your rights, as well as who you are. It's your identity. You know, you have the rights to this and that and everything, and that's passed down to the next generation. We don't do that anymore. Why? Because you see things like inheritance tax. Inheritance tax is immoral. It's a violation of the moral code. It's like stealing some of your DNA and not letting it go down to your children. You're not allowed to have any more. And, you know, there's actually scientists thinking about doing this. In, you know, with their gene splicing, they're actually going to violate the DNA. And they're doing it already. And they want to, there's actually even talk among some in the scientific community that people with certain genetic disorders not be allowed to breed. Yeah, I mean, that's where it leads to. Your age of reason will lead to this. Which is why you had people like your primary evolutionists who were total racists. And not, you know, people always equate racism with, you know, blacks. But they thought that no Anglo-Saxon should ever marry an Irishman. That was Darwin's opinion, that you would get something less than human if you know, an Anglo-Saxon Norwegian or something married an Irishman. Well, that's where I came from. My dad was half Irish and my mom was all Norwegian, so according to Darwin, I'm a degenerate. Most people don't know that because that was clipped out of their tree of knowledge, that Darwin was such a racist. But of course, his way of thinking leads to that in the age of enlightenment, where you think you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps of your brain. Back to what I was talking about just before the break. If you have an inalienable right to choose, and your brain and your body is simply a product of evolution, chemical, natural selection. You know, it's just about environment and the chemistry of your DNA. And that you have evolved up to this point with no divine interference. Then there is no choice. There's no free will. Because whatever you choose is just a product of your environment, your DNA, your mental capacity and your environment, what's been fed in by teachers and environment and reactions and events of your life is going to produce a brain that's going to make decisions based on, you know, this, you know, bounce off this, bounce off that. You're going to end up with a decision. There's no free choice in a godless evolutionary society. And we explain this in good enough detail with scientific references. What they're saying is that free choice, God created man, breathed life into man. Exactly how he did that, it doesn't go into the details. But then God retracted his own will in order to give you the right to choose. That the right to choose is a retraction of God's will. You're not a puppet. And they talk about preordained and destiny, but this is because you really only have one choice. And that is to serve God or not. That's his retraction. He gives you the choice of serving him. And why would you serve him? Because you love him. Why do you love him? Because you love the character of God. What is the character of God? He's a giver of life. A covetous relationship is not a giver relationship. It's a taker relationship. There are no socialists in the kingdom of God. Because the socialist, you know, people say Christ was a socialist. Well, in a sense, he was. But without the gun, without the coercion. And this is what God is. God is a socialist. He wants you to share everything you have with everybody around you in a righteous sort of way to strengthen the poor. He wants you to do that. But he doesn't want to force. He retracts the force and allows you to choose to be like him. Because, see, God shared his life with you. He wants you, and if God is in you, share your life with others. This is why charity is so important. Charity is love. The word that we see, you know, and even if a man gives away everything he has and he has not charity. Well, wait a minute. If he just gave away everything he has, he must be charitable, right? No, it's a different word. Really, in the Bible, you see the word grace. That's the word you should be translating charity, generally speaking. And you see the word charity. It's every time Jesus says it, they translate it love. Because there are two kinds of love. There's the sucking love. I need you. I love you. I want you. That sucking life love. And the other love is a giving love. It's you. I want to give to you. I want to share with you. I want to bless you. I want to help you. I want to help you up, become stronger. You see, that's the other kind of love. They are as different as night and day, and we call them both love. One love draws you into covetous relationships because you want. I love the democracy because it has so many benefits. They take care of my teeth when I go to New Zealand, and I'm not even a New Zealander. I think it's a wonderful thing. I actually had a guy telling me this. I love it. He just... And everybody in New Zealand is, every child born, every those little cute New Zealand babies, they're born $50,000 in debt or more now. Because he loves New Zealand because it's a social democracy and I can go there and I can have my teeth fixed and they will do it for free. He loves that. That's the sucking love. He doesn't mind that your children will be born $50,000 or $54,000 or $55,000 or $56,000 in debt. He just loves the fact that he can get his teeth fixed for free. He is a covetous Satanist. But he thinks he believes in Christ. He thinks he believes in God. He thinks Christ came to lay down his life. He's not going to New Zealand to lay down his life. He's going to New Zealand to get his teeth fixed. And he thinks he's moral. And so does Schumer. And so does all these other enlightened people who think that socialism leads to a more moral society. It's actually leading to more immoral society. It just spreads the immorality out in a thinner but broader layer. So everybody is tainted with it. And what happens is those systems always grow up. The debt grows faster because their desire makes it grow faster until it ultimately collapses. And then they eat each other. They've been taking a bite out of each other. Now they devour each other in debt and curse their children. And we'll talk more about this when we return to Keys of the Kingdom next time. Till then, peace on your house, and may God be with you.